You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast on the Medics Academy Network.
Welcome back to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast. In this session, I'm going to be speaking with Sarita Taneja and Stu Plumley on patient liaison and follow-up. What I wanted to do in the episode is really just outline and do a deep dive into first points of medical contact, examining how we learn from events from a patient's perspective. So doing this by really looking at patient liaison and follow-up for both the patient's benefit and indeed the clinician's benefit. So additionally, ongoing liaison both humanizes patients and indeed builds trust and rapport with clinicians and can bring closure for EMS personnel who often only witness the initial phase of patient care. So Stuart Plumley is the patient and family aftercare lead at Kent Surrey Sussex Air Ambulance Trust. He's also an emeritus HEMS paramedic and indeed a critical care paramedic with CCAM. Sarita is the patient and family aftercare manager at Kent Surrey and Sussex Air Ambulance and was awarded the Charity Staff Member of the Year at Air Ambulance UK Awards of Excellence in 2022. Welcome both to the podcast.
Hello. Hi.
I wonder if we could just kick off, indeed, to you both, just to speak to your journey into these roles and how important you see them being. And Sarita, if we could just go with you yourself first.
Thank you. Mine's an unusual route into aftercare. I'm non-clinical, so I don't have any background in medicine, so I can't save lives like all of you wonderful people. My background is 20 years in the charity sector. I have been predominantly in fundraising, looking at community events and community fundraisers and groups, and have done that and started that here at the Air Ambulance about 8 years ago. In 2 years into my role in community fundraising, I was asked to cover patient visits as an interim for maternity cover. And I never stopped. It got under my skin, I think. There's a lot of similarities in the skills that you bring to looking after people. As a fundraiser, you're building relationships, stewarding, nurturing. And I think that's why they'd originally asked me to do the visits and the fundraising side of looking after bereaved families and patients. It was a natural transferable skills that I had, but I underestimated, I think, everyone that I would get hold of it and not really want to give it up. It became incredibly important to me. And so I just kind of kept trying to see what we could add to it. And so my route is unusual, but I think at the heart of it is just looking after people.
And to yourself, Stu.
I joined the ambulance service quite late, actually. I was about 30 when I joined the ambulance service, and then, you know, did bits and pieces and then became a critical care paramedic, and which I have been now for about 15 years, I think. And then also a year later, was really fortunate enough to be able to join Kent Surrey Sussex Air Ambulance as one of the HEMS paramedics. And you know, about 13 years, I think it is. When you get old, you don't want to keep time a bit, it's horrible. And then as my career's progressed, and working with incredible people, which have been very fortunate, I was asked if I would be interested in the patient family aftercare role. And I didn't know too much about it, but I thought there was something I could add, and subsequently, you know, was given that opportunity to become the lead, and very proud to work alongside Sarita and other colleagues. But for me, I underestimated the power of aftercare and how its strength is. The spirit of aftercare. We can talk about the words, but you really got to understand the holistical spirit behind it and how the emotions that you can give and look after is incredibly, incredibly powerful. And I absolutely adore the role.
It's really interesting you say that, actually, Stu, because there is a spirit behind it, and that you're right, that spirit is of kind of rehabilitation of convalescence, really. So, you know, patients on that journey, but you're almost journeying with them. And I think there's probably a lot of job satisfaction to be garnered from journeying with patients through that rehabilitation role. And it's something we, you know, we rarely get to see as paramedics, you know, the bigger picture. And I can imagine there's a lot of job satisfaction that lies within that.
Absolutely. You're right, you have this journey with them. And me and Sarita are very fortunate enough to be invited into their lives. And we were discussing this earlier. We look at our patients and their injuries and we look after them. But we also then join their families. And often, like all families, they're complex. So we pick up the complexities of their families. And we then have to understand those complexities. And then also, because you understand them, work alongside them. And you're non-judgmental about it, but you suddenly become part of them. And you know, that's very humbling. It's very nice to be invited in. You're very honoured. And then you hopefully help them on their road to recovery. And it is recovery, but it's not back to normal. There's a new normal now. And it's now understanding, nurturing, and in some cases, embracing the new normal. And that's not all the time, but some cases you can embrace the new normal.
Sarita, could you just unpack for us the process, or indeed the initial process, how you initiate contact, how you maintain contact with patients and families?
Yeah, of course. So we're very reactive to people. We've started to initiate trying to be a bit more proactive. So we've got aftercare cards now that the crews are carrying with them, pilots as well, because they're at the forefront of interacting with people. But historically and still, we are reactive to patients and bereaved families getting in touch with us. And that can come in different ways. That can come from letters, phone calls into the charity, forms being completed on our website. But we've seen a really big upturn on social media interaction. So with our marketing team, we've worked really hard of trying to build a safe space for everybody. So we've become very personalised on our responses. People know that we're actually reading the comments. We do a lot of direct messaging to get consent. So we're different in the sense that we're not going into our HemSpace, which is our database for all of our clinical notes. We're not going in and contacting people that way. We are waiting for them to get in contact with us. So they're ready. So it's when they're ready. And that's how we're really building our relationships at the moment. And we take them on the journey that they need to at the pace they want to. So I think a lot of people have an image of aftercare being about visits and one-to-one. And there is an element of that. But it's also about texts and emails and phone calls. It takes a long time for people to get to know you, to feel comfortable to come and sit with you and talk to you. So we build the journey based on the needs of the family members and the patients and our bereaved families.
Sarita just made a really excellent point there about taking patients just as fast or indeed as slow as they need to go. Could you maybe unpack and speak to just indeed how important it is to piece together for patients their initial injury, the incidents, and fill in the gaps on their rehabilitation just as fast or as slow as they need to go?
So when we first, we've only been going 2 years, not 2 years as yet. And when we first met our patients and they wanted to meet our crew, we got everybody in a room. And I mean, even before we get there, it depends on the patient in terms of the trust built. And this is where Sarita's outstanding work comes in. She has to have this. The visit bit's probably a 1% part of the work. The trust that is gained by Sarita in terms of the telephone conversations and all of that good work takes that process can take weeks to months to years. And then when they do come and meet us, initially we used to get everybody in a room and our crews would talk through the clinical stuff. What we noticed very early on, actually there was some awkwardness and anxiety created by using that process. You know, the crews were having to talk about you know, what was the expectation of the family or the patient, and trying to understand that and then fill the gaps. But because they were emotionally involved in the treatment, that you could see that was a little bit disjointed. So we've changed that process. And what we do is we initially meet the patient and their family. And one of either myself or another clinician will sit and talk through the clinical bit first and try and ascertain where they are in their journey of recovery. And it's once we're happy and we're all comfortable where we are, we then introduce the crew and then they come and meet them. And it's much more holistic conversations rather than, you know, very hard clinical stuff. And to be honest, most people aren't interested in the clinical stuff. Most people are interested in, you know, especially around bereaved families, you know, bereaved families want to know, were their loved ones cared for, you know, and the ceiling of treatment may have stopped, but what we can offer is that we know the ceiling of care didn't stop. We continue to care for their loved ones, the bereaved patient at scene, even though they've passed away. So, but by doing it in a staged approach, it's a much more comfortable, less emotionally impacting for everybody, and that's part of the visit process that we have. We also do a debrief afterwards as a crew and facilitators of the visit. We sit down and we talk and learn and discuss. And you know, are we all happy? And the welfare of the crew, are they happy? I'm very aware of the expectation of our crews and the potential moral trauma that they could be suffering. So I always want to make sure, in terms of their own welfare, it's kids.
So, Sarita, Stu has just mentioned around, you know, the how the patient interacts and indeed how important it is for the patient to fill in those gaps and that interface with the crew. But could you maybe speak to the wider family and indeed sort of what benefits to the wider family patient liaison has to just to fill in the gaps for them?
I think when we started to talk about aftercare, we specifically were really keen to say patient and family aftercare. We were very thought out in the title that we gave our organisation in this service. Patients are wonderful when they know they're wonderful. When they come in, they're the stars of the show. But the impact that it has on family members has always been really clear that they're the biggest impact sometimes. And I think it becomes very clear to us that patients are aware themselves that their families have suffered a lot. So we're always really keen to foster the relationship, sometimes as much, if not more, with those family members, the wives, the daughters, the sons, because they've seen everything pretty much play out. Patients always say, oh, I was completely unaware of what was going on. I was in a coma for weeks. They haven't got a clue, but their family members have had to watch something really hard. They've had to carry on. They've had to make big decisions. They've had to rally and be tired and carry on making big decisions for their family members. So we're always very mindful that what we offer is equal to everybody that comes. We do give a little bit of, obviously, sometimes when they first walk in, we're like, you're the patient, hello. But we don't focus on it for too long. We always make sure that they understand that the time they have with us is all of them.
So just looking at that for a second, actually, Sarita, and just looking at how just some of the models, because you've just notioned towards, you know, it's a standardized approach to the patient or indeed there's a framework around that. Could you maybe speak to some of the models of patient liaison and follow-up that you've both seen and observed from other services and indeed which model you chose to go with to adopt within KSS?
We decided to make the KSS model. So we have definitely looked at the expertise of other air ambulances and networked with them. We are in a network with all of them together. We swap notes. We ask each other for help all the time. So we definitely gathered information, but we were really clear that we wanted to make the service that we needed for our patients and families, but also incorporated the geography of the area, the clinicians that we have, the ethos of the charity is the KSS way. And that runs throughout the whole of the organisation. Whether you are a fundraiser, a volunteer, service delivery, we have a KSS way. And the KSS way is that patients are at the heart of everything we do. So we definitely have taken ideas, we have chatted to people, but we've been very keen to build it, the model for ourselves. And it was really important to our chief executive and our executive director that we had the link into the charity. So we're unusual in the fact that we're very embedded with our income generation and marketing and comms teams. So we're on base with them. We help them with patient stories. Today's event, we were the ones that got the patients there. So we're really embedded. We work as one team. And that was something that we were really keen to do. And I think probably that's where my background is, to bridge the gap. So those times where there's a little bit of lack of information, I can sometimes put my old hat on and think, what is it we all need here? So we definitely look to other organisations, but we've definitely tried to build something that we're really proud of.
And to yourself, Stu?
Yeah, I was, you know, I'm a clinician through and through, so it's very, very clinically orientated, my approach to this. But what was very immediate to me was the amazing skill Sarita has in from her charity side and a fundraising background and all of that. And when patients want to, they want to give back. So giving back is very much something they want to do. We don't force it on them. They have no obligation to you know, give a patient story, to fundraise, to being part of a campaign. If they want to, we will facilitate that for them. And then what Sarita facilitates that process. And when they're going through that process, we look after them from an aftercare perspective, working alongside our colleagues, Gavin and others that you know, then make that story happen or whatever. And I it's really interesting for me. It gives a bit of completion to their journey. It helps them with their journey, and you know, you can, and at any point that they go, do you know what, I want to move on now, we can make that happen as well. And they've had, you know, they want to move on, which is often for us, that's quite a nice feeling. We know that they're now moving to another part of their life and they're not involved with us anymore. Yeah, obviously we're disappointed to see them go because we've forged these lovely relationships. We're also quite pleased that they're able to do this now on their own.
Stu, let's look at the fundamental benefits to the clinician, because it's not just for the family's benefit, but I fundamentally believe it's probably equally as beneficial for the clinician actually to see sort of this journey and this rehabilitation. But could you maybe unpack some of your anecdotal experience, or indeed some of your perspectives on sort of from a clinician's perspective, the fruition of this patient journey and this patient rehabilitation?
So for me, being a clinician again, and a couple of our patients who we currently look after, I've actually looked after myself. So yeah, you're a little bit not any more invested, but you just have this emotional connection. But one of the things I was very aware of quite early on, and it was only anecdotal at that time, was that our clinicians seemed a little bit uncomfortable, and that's hence why, as I discussed earlier, we changed the process. But nevertheless, you could still, there was lots of questions, body language were given away, that, you know, were that they wanted to do the right thing, but they were a little bit uncomfortable, and there seemed to be some anxiety present, especially around bereaved families, meeting a bereaved family. So we did some research around that, and you know, I'm not an academic, so I'm not going to try and explain this in a way that it will come across academically, if that's the right word. But the research we did, it was retrospective. We ideally wanted to do it prospectively, but retrospectively, we asked them to fill out an anxiety score, GAD-7, essentially, with some contextualized questions. And we, the results, and that this was the whole HEMS crew, the pilots, the dispatchers, the paramedics, the doctors, the whole group of, you know, clinicians of that day looking after these patients. And we noted there was a reduction in their anxiety. They had anxiety, and after they've seen their patient, there was a reduction in anxiety of a significant level. And that bit of work hopefully will be published soon. But that spurred me to, you know, my anecdotal evidence or gut feeling was right, and I'm pleased that we've been able to evidence that. But also it spurs me, there's loads of other areas that we can gather evidence to see where else we can improve and nuance the care we're giving, as I say, not only for our patients, but for our clinicians as well.
Yeah, I think that's powerful, actually, Stu, for a number of reasons, but absolutely powerful. Just looking at how this, from Sarita, from your perspective, just looking at maybe when this, there isn't a good news story in the end of this, when the patient is actually palliative, or when the injury load is so severe, but there is sort of maybe more of a progressive death. Could you maybe speak to your perspective on if it's still beneficial for the family to meet the crew? Is it still sort of beneficial for the clinician to sort of be engaged in that journey? How does that play out?
I think how patients in that situation or bereaved families are really unique, and we do take a different standpoint on it. What I think is that when we are building this relationship, we're always really humbled by it. In the saddest of moments, some of the biggest relationships we've built are with these family members, and it never stops being powerful. I think what we do is we take it gently. We always keep the crew that are involved up to date of where we're at and what we're doing. But what I think what Stu has touched on is that because they have us, when we say to them, we're in touch with bereaved families, because we are looking after our crew as much as we are our patients, there's a trust that they know that we would never put them in a position that we wouldn't put ourselves in. So I think the relationships there are gradual and slower. But I think where we feel it is beneficial, we will always give that option to our crews. But actually, what is different with our bereaved families or those that are going to lose family members is that it's not about the specific crew. It's about the link to the charity. It's about the link to what could be fostered in the future. It's the support. So we've got relationships with bereaved families that they've still not met their crew, but we have a very strong relationship with them. It's a different kind of, it's a different being.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you said, it's a very, not fragile, but like you said, very tentative, very sensitive approach. So, and I'm sure there's many nuances and subtleties of that approach, and for each specific situation, but absolutely. And so just pivoting slightly, Stu, and looking at the clinical governance perspective and what can be sort of fed back and learnt indeed from crews engaging with families and indeed patients on the back end of interventions, when there's been either a massive injury load or indeed looking at some of the clinical interventions on scene, how beneficial is it from a clinical governance perspective?
So in terms of just following on for Sarita, I think there's something really important to add, actually, because when we're dealing with these really difficult emotions, What has been really incredible for us is how the crew have looked after us. So we go back in the crew room and they've been, how are you? You know, how did that go? Are you okay? Complete 360 when we're like, we're doing this for you, the patient and you, and now they're turning it around. And that's been an incredibly powerful, powerful thing for me. In terms of governance, you know, all of this, when we meet our patients, everything we do is documented, within our EPCR process, HEMSBase. And what's often fed back in terms of their ability for further treatment is to highlight their personalities to shine through. Don't become a robot when you're treating people. If you feel the need to say something nice or caring, which most people do all the time, but you might feel a bit uncomfortable about holding a hand or stroking a cheek. We joke, me and Sarita. Sarita can often tell who the crew are by the feedback she gets from the patient, by their holistic, I use that word a lot, but their, you know, the way they are with them, the fact that we know a doctor is stroke to treat, we know who that doctor's going to be. We know by language use who that paramedic's going to be. And it's often that nice, soft touches that are remembered and shine through. So when we feedback in terms of clinical governance, it's not always about the medicine. The other thing that's really interesting in terms of from a governance and is the dispatchers, the importance of the dispatchers. They often want to know their role in terms of how did the aircraft get there. And also, and you'll know this as a clinician and our ambulance call takers, you know, the lowest paid, but probably the hardest job in the ambulance service. That person that took that call, they want to know about that person as well. So that these are the things that we feedback that we can then, it's probably not so much, it is a governance thing, but we can then feed that back to them to realise their importance and how they conduct themselves. And all of these things, I think, are relevant to.
I think as well, since I've joined, I think I'm the normal human in the room. I see what our patients see. I see how great you all are. I'm the fan. I get it. When you walk in, I get what they say. But what's been really important to me for the crew to understand is that patients and families trust your medicine. When you arrive on scene, they trust that you know your medicine. But what they get is the human side of you. You're all great human beings. And when they're wanting to interact with you and when they're wanting to get to know you, it's not about your medicine. They see what I see. And it's these people that in their worst moments have come and they've helped them. You've left that mark. And it's been really important for me to get to across to the crew that that's what they're seeing. That's what they see when you walk in the room. Reds and everything, crew, pilots, dispatchers. It's that you're really, really good people. And that's what we've been trying to put across to them. I think you're getting there.
Sarita, I think that's powerful from a number of reasons. But like you said, just that human element, Stu just highlighted it as well. That element of actually we are all human in this process, and actually this is a relationship based initiative to help guide and assist in that process. But it's powerful to see the system, because you just also said, as did Stu, around, you know, call takers, dispatchers, paramedics, doctors, and everyone, including yourselves, are involved. It's not, you know, to sound cheesy, but one person doesn't save a life, a system saves a life. And actually to have that family and patients see that the system is not only safe, but it's helped contribute to their care. It is powerful, and it has, like you said, it gives the patient that real human sense that there's humans looking after humans. Because you're right, I think that can get lost sometimes, and actually reinstalling that is powerful. So Sarita, could I just get you to speak to an anecdotal experience of your own, actually, if that's okay, just of where you've seen patient liaison, patient and family liaison profoundly change and affect crews for the better?
I think the ones that always get us all are when there's children involved. It's normal. The biggest one I think that I've always seen is when we looked after a lady that was pregnant and she had a cardiac arrest. And I remember the phone call because she never told me what had happened to the baby. So I'm sitting there thinking, at what point do I ask if he's here? What happened? And we've now, 5 years on, we've had the pleasure to see him growing up. And he comes back and he sees the crew, his crew. We say that we saved two lives that day, and we did. But we all, when he went to school, I sent them all a message, and they're like, this is a proud moment. When they see him, he knows them. He will go up and hug them. And for me, that exactly instills what aftercare is about. It's where people feel comfortable, where crew feel comfortable, where we feel comfortable, you build that relationship. And it's one we're all really proud of. Whenever we see him, we love him to bits. They're a really fundamental part of what we call the KSS family. And that's their reminder on a bad day that good things can happen, because it's not all happiness all the time. So I think where children involved, they're always the ones. Or where the crew have said to Stu and I, can you keep your ear to the ground and see if you hear from them? And there's been a few where we said, yeah, of course, thinking, I don't know if we will we? And there was one where I was too, was one I was in the crew one Sunday, sitting there minding my own business, waiting to do a visit. Stu was out as a CCP, and I heard his voice over the radio, and I thought, oh, what's he up to? What's he getting into trouble with? And it was the most amazing moment of seeing our crew rally. As soon as they heard Stu's phone on that radio, everyone was up on their feet and ready to help. And then we got to meet the patient. We heard from the patient. And it's just this really wonderful moment of what you said earlier. It takes people. It takes systems. We've seen that patient through. We know he's got children. Like, it's all of those things where you see the outcomes of the ripple effect that Stu calls it. The patient's there, but where does it go? And it just keeps going and going and going, and it impacts so many people. We're really lucky that we get those moments in aftercare. For every hard day, and there are sad days, you have a reminder every day of what it is we all do, and you have to bring yourself back to that sometimes.
That's profound, actually, Sarita. It's profound for a number of reasons, but like you said, that job satisfaction of bringing you back to that baseline of why you're there at work in the first place. So for my next question, I'd like to hear from both of you, actually. I'll pose it to Stu first, but Sarita, I'd like to get your thoughts on this, because patient and family liaison is it's a tool and a conduit of relationship building, which shouldn't, my belief is, it shouldn't necessarily just be an air ambulance initiative. There's lots of work to be done in ambulance services, so just in the wider ambulance service, but also for the wider international listenership. Stu, initially, and then to Sarita, could you maybe just outline why this initiative should be considered for other services?
I think if we, knowledge is power, isn't it? And if we work together with different organisations, you know, I've got a colleague who works for the private sector as an aftercare lead, who's a clinician. And I won't mention her name, but you'll know her, I have no doubt. But, you know, she's doing some great work within the private sector. And I think collectively we become quite powerful, and then with that collaborative working, we can feel the little links that make that journey possible, and it makes it much more seamless and less jerky if we work together. And I think aftercare could become something really, really good, and economically could be a good thing, because I just think people's recovery will get better. We've seen some of our patients, I talked about embracing the new normal. There's one guy who has completely changed his life and is doing amazing stuff for a lot of people, you know, and his work has rippled out to lots and lots of people in way of festivals and stuff. It's incredible the work he's done, and he was one of our former patients. But I know he's got the drive and the determination to make that happen. If we could do that with so many other patients with collaborative working, I think we can do. I think aftercare can be something very, very special.
And Sarita, where do you see aftercare, indeed, patient liaison and family liaison going?
I think that it has the potential to take over from the dynamics of people thinking there needs to be a route and a journey, and people looking after people. one of the biggest things we've done early was peer support. We weren't meant to do it until year three, but we saw a need and we did it. And the biggest profound work that we do now is sitting in a room and letting people look after people. And by bringing people together who have collaborated, we're one part of someone's journey. You know, there's the crews on the ground first, there's police, there's everyone. If we could bring all of those together, you would help, everyone would help each other, I think. It's the holistic part is sometimes frowned upon, and it's a bit wishy-washy, but it's the thing that will probably help people the most.
And so as an adjoining to that, and I absolutely agree with what you're saying, could you see it and sort of this being a national role, or indeed standardized across air ambulances, or indeed ambulance services? Is there room for a patient and family liaison team as almost like a mandated team in personal care?
If you build it, they will come, I think, because if we're doing it and other air ambulances are doing great work in their patch, and, you know, all slightly different, but we're all talking to each other because of the type of people we are. We're not precious. We want to share. I think it will be organic. I think it will just simply happen. And there's something quite sweet about that in itself, actually. So I think it there, whether there be a standard, who knows? But I definitely think it's here to stay.
And Sarita, from your perspective?
I think Stu's right. I think it will just grow naturally. I think when you see things working and we're all looking at each other and we're all learning from each other, when you see positive things happen, people will be drawn to it. Stu's completely right. If it was something a bit dampened down and it was a nicety, I'm not sure. But there are good things happening from all of us. Positive things for everybody that impact everybody that's ever been involved in it. So us as an organisation, crews who have been on the ground, patients and families, it is endless. So I think it's a natural thing that will happen. You've just got to believe in it and not be scared of it.
So just as we come into land on the conversation, actually, if there's a final question I could just pose to you both, there's many progressive services out there, many progressive air ambulances on an international basis as well. If one of those clinicians or indeed institutions was thinking about taking the next steps, could you maybe advocate as to some practical tips or indeed tricks or just steps they could take just to initiate a system or indeed a scheme? I'll ask it to possibly Stu first and then Sarita.
I think that's really interesting. I think it's a couple of things for me. First, go and see what other services have got and go to a visit. Go and sit into a visit if you can. That's easier said than done just because of the, you know, the governance around it. But be part of a visit and actually feel what's going on. But a bit more than just a visit, the day with the crews and see. And do it a couple of times to get that feel for it. And then go back and see what's going to suit your service. I think that's really important. You can try and mirror stuff over, but because of the uniqueness of each individual service, I think you've then got to make it fit your service and your hospitals and all of that, those logistical elements that are going to drive how you go forward is the things. And believe in it, really, really believe in it, because, like I said, right at the beginning about the spirit of it, that's, I think, the key for me.
And Sarita, to yourself.
Yeah, I think Stu said all the right thing. And I think be prepared that it will change you. You're never going to be the same again, in a good way. I will never feel the same. I will never take things for granted. It will become a part of you in a way that you won't prepare yourself for. So if you're going to go and do it and you think it's just going to be a job, and I'm going to go and do a structure and I'm going to have a process and I'm going to tick the boxes, you're not the right person. You can't deliver it. We joke around and say, Stu will leave me a message and say, 24-hour aftercare. We are 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, because you become invested in it because you care. So be prepared. to let it become a huge part of you, and then you'll embrace it and you'll do great things, I think.
Listen, that's a fantastic place to finish. Thank you so much to both of you. It's just been actually really quite powerful to hear that message and just the components of the initiative. So thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care podcast on the Medics Academy Network.